Call my rum.
Soy morena, soy negra, apréndetelo, no te equivoques conmigo. Recuerda lo que es racista, ignorante, asúmelo. Vas a tener que aguantarme.
Being raised in the United States, that there's certain choices that I can make that are privileged choices that, like, my mom didn't have. Because even the opportunity to look at your life and feel confident enough to pick and choose the traditions that you want to perpetuate,
mm-hmm.
is,
the ones you want to live.
Right, is a privilege that often we would not have had.
But it's also the way that you drag, because I think draggings are necessary for growth. Or if, you know, what is it, who don't hear feel? If you're not hearing it, you know, the dragging is the closest to, you know, getting a slap across the face, which sometimes is necessary.
I completely disagree. I don't think a slap across the face is ever necessary.
No, not in real time. Not in...
Not a literal.
Yeah,
yeah,
no.
But for me, language is really... I don't know, you know, at home, you know, at home in Panama. It's so strange for me to have to say that, those two things. Language was very, sometimes very volatile, right? Mm-hmm. Especially with the elders. And they would use that kind of language. And to me, it was always like...
It's true.
Right? So I have done a lot of work myself to almost eliminate that language. Because it's not who I want to relate with myself.
Uh-huh. What language do you mean?
The violent language that I grew up with,
uh-huh.
Like the dragging, the slap across the face.
I got you.
That kind of thing is still very. Even though it's not literal, right? Mm-hmm. It's still like, and now, trust me, sometimes I want to pop my kids. I want to pop them so hard. Sometimes I even want to drop kick them across the street. Like, I really do. Physically, right? I wish I could, like, pick them up and drop them.
Drop kick. No, drop kick is always funny to me because of Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. Finish them.
Drop kick them. And they're so little, JV. Like, they would go far.
You know, like, nobody will make, like, I honestly believe that nobody will fuck you up like your kids, like, emotionally and fit, like, you just, like, si no te me sientas, yo! Like,
exactly, but I have never verbally told them that,
yeah.
And I would never verbally tell them that. Now, what I have been doing, right, is reminding them, because I do feel like I use reminders. I have reminded them that if I had ever done that, that they would never be able to imagine what my parents would have done to me.
Uh-huh.
Right? And then they want to know, like, well, what did they do? Right? And then I would be like, what's the worst thing that you could picture Abuelita doing or Abu doing? And it's usually so simple. Oh, they would have hit you like this. And I'm like, oh, that's the, I'm doing like a good job, because that's the worst that they can picture.
That snapped you by the back of your head.
Right. Right. If that's the worst that they can picture, I would have never allowed that to happen.
And I think about the fact that, you know, things happen as they should or at the time that they should. Because imagine if, like, a generation that was used to spanking would have been living in this environment right now.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And with justification, right? Of people being like, te portas bien, behave yourself, sit your ass down, right? Like, can you imagine the type of beatings that kids would be getting right now? Like, that would just, that completely, like, it derails me when I think about.
But some are getting those beatings.
I was gonna say Evelyn.
No, but I'm saying that I think that right? Like, yes, there are some that are having those types of beatings, unfortunately. But, like, thinking about such a significant, at least in my experience, like,
there's a consciousness
of people, right? There's a consciousness, there is a little bit more of an awareness, and there's also more social stigma associated with beating your children now, right? For example, look at kids that might be have, that would have had undiagnosed special needs a generation ago.
Mm-hmm.
right?
They got beat.
They got beat, right? Yeah. For no reason.
They got abused.
For no reason.
And they might still get abused now, but the diagnosis certainly helps prevent some level of, hopefully, some level of abuse that would have just been normal, that people would have just been like, they don't know how to act, beat their ass constantly. Like, that would have been the consistent answer.
Well, it gives a reason. It gives a reason.
Most of the reasons that we all got beats, though, is because of parents' frustrations, to be honest.
Yes. Yes.
It's not even our own actions.
Right.
Because I've been there. I've been so frustrated, as I said, you know, the things that I have gone through my mind and how I can actually visualize them. And then I have to, like, okay, Genevieve, they're only, you know, 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old. Evelyn tells me it doesn't end. My mom tells me it doesn't end, and I'm 46.
It escalates.
That she physically can't do nothing.
It morphs. It morphs into something different. But you know what? I think that for me, that was probably single-handedly the reason why I opted to not be, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I recognized that there was a time where I was really overwhelmed, and on top of, like, doing things to keep us alive, right, that behavior just felt like so much more of an affront, that I really knew that I needed to automatically, like, remove certain things from my toolbox as a parent in order to be able to successfully engage my son. Because I would have certainly been that parent that was like, you know, you woke up 2 minutes late, I'm gonna spank you. You did this, you know? Like, no, it becomes extreme. And I see it all the time in other people who have not made that decision to say, I am not gonna spank. And what happens is that you spank all the time, right? And it's unfortunate, because I think some people still believe that that is a go-to method, right? Of consistently, right? That is a go-to method of getting kids in line. And my thing is always like, if you gotta spank your kids more than once for the same infraction, then maybe that shit ain't work.
Like, I honestly made the connection. I think I was probably like 26 or 27. I was already living on my own in Atlanta. And I can't remember what it was, but I was really being grounded. I was grounding myself, and I had a mentor at the time, and I was grounding myself in human rights and a lot of human rights work and policy and organizing and activism and everything else. And I was really studying the rights of the child. And now most of this is independent study, because there's nothing, United States doesn't believe in human rights like that. And at that point, you know, when I was reflecting, I told myself, right, when and if I have children, I cannot hit them. I cannot hit them if I am about human rights, if I'm like a real person that really believes in human rights. Because the only reason that I'm able to hit a child, or the only reason that adults can hit children, is because they're powerless. Mm-hmm. That's what human rights is. Mm-hmm. It's a game of power. So the only reason that adults feel that they can hit children, mm-hmm, is because of ownership, mm-hmm, and access to power.
And they can't hit back.
Right. So it's for me, it was less of a human, like, mothering philosophy and all that, and more of as a person that fundamentally believes in the rights of other people, mm-hmm, fundamentally, like, to my core, I believe that we're all entitled to these rights. I cannot violate somebody else's rights based, mm-hmm, on my understanding of my own power.
Yeah.
Period.
I agree.
And that has been, like, when I've spoken to other people and other parents, because when people tell me, like, oh, you know, like, that's a white thing, not hitting children, or Jamaicans hit, you know, you don't know Jamaicans. And I'm like, I'm always like, well, first of all, I'm not white.
Yeah.
Because I'm not white. I'm Jamaican descent as well. I'm also from Latin America. I'm also a slave descendant. Like, what are all the arguments that you're using to justify hitting? And I understand the cultural piece. I grew up in the era of hitting. Mm-hmm. But let's imagine a world where we don't hit children.
Yeah.
Let's just imagine it. What are some things that would just be like taken off, right? And domestic violence to me is one of them.
Well, I think there's a certain freedom in being able to choose not to hit, because for a long time it was for survival.
Of course.
You know, like, portate bien, like, don't embarrass, number one, don't embarrass me in front of these white people. That's always the subtext in a lot of it, you know, and throughout the years. And it's going to be more and more as we get more people to understand that we can imagine more. But I remember growing up, and my parents didn't spank me often. Like, we were just really obedient. We were really, we followed what our parents said. We had a fear of our parents. I'm still scared of my mom.
Yeah, I'm scared of my parents. I feel like I had younger cousins in Panama that didn't get hit. I feel like it was only like the older four, and I'm number two in the older four that got a lot of spankings and beatings.
Yeah.
And then the younger ones, and it's like eight of them.
That's probably how it worked out. My older cousins probably got beat more than I did, and they lived and grew up, born in Panama, and I lived and grew up in the States. So that also is a difference. That my mother left Panama when she was 19, pregnant with me, and so it was a different way of viewing things, especially from her old community in Colón. You know, it's very insular, it's very black, it's very Afro-Caribbean, West Indian influence. Mm-hmm. And so her going to, you know, immigrating to Brooklyn, yeah, that's also little West Indies, but it's also other ideas being able to permeate. And so, I don't know, I think they just kind of made that decision, you know, we don't have to go off on y'all every single infraction, because she said she didn't like that growing up. Like, my grandmother did that to her, and she didn't like it. So she tried not to do it with us, or in this context, she does it a little bit less, but, you know, we never want to admit that we're like our parents. But yeah, it's, you know, obviously a lot of these intergenerational cycles are going to be broken with each generation. Hopefully that's the goal.
And I think that there's also room to really doing the imagining, just to recognize that the people who have the most access to imagine are also often the people who have the closest association with whiteness in some sort of way that is completely different, right? And so recognizing and acknowledging that, right? Because it's like, that's the other space that the people who are most marginalized often are still centering the white gaze in ways because of the fact that that's really important. Like, that's differently important to them. Yeah. So moving that, like, I certainly got spanked. I hated it. I also didn't love the relationship that that I had with my mom as a result, because I was, and you know, this is, again, this is a cultural and generational thing where it was like, I always joked that I only had two options for like feelings in my home, which were happiness and gratitude. And so anything that fell short of that wasn't really honored. It was like, you know, malagradecida, like that was a really offensive thing to be, right? And so I always felt like there were lots of things that I had to do that I, not necessarily that I was told, but that I incorporated as like, okay, this is the way to be, that I also knew that when I had a kid, I didn't want to follow. So for example, like the idea of cleaning your plate.
Cleaning what?
Cleaning your plate. Like if you don't like food, if you don't like the food, you shouldn't, like, what, WC, right?
I'm so guilty.
So I've never made my son clean his plate because he has a right to not like something, right? And so it's like, if that's not your thing, that's not your thing. But also, and most of the time, honestly, the other side of it is that he's typically like, clean a plate. Like, the, you know, I was thinking that I can literally think of one food that my mom cooked that I was like, I don't even want no parts, right? Which is tripe, mondongo. Like, I can't.
Oh, yeah, that. No. Absolutely.
Only
not.
My grandmother's.
I can't stand it.
No.
I would lick the plate.
The elders love that. Tripe and then bofe, which is cow's brain. I'm like, we's free.
No. Bofe is lung. Bofe is lung.
Oh, it's lung? Which is the brain? There's a brain.
Sí, pero yo no como eso. Sesos.
Yeah, no one should.
Sesos. But the, oh no.
Yeah, but bofe is lung. Yeah.
The fried bofe?
You like bofe? See, that's you. Then you see the generations and the traditions, right? Like, or also just personality.
What is buffet? Can you explain?
Lung, and you make it like French fries.
What? Fried lung? Lung of what?
cow.
Wait a minute. We are so fucking creative.
We're what?
We are so creative. Delicious. Who decided the lung is left? We're going to saute it, season it. Right? And what does it taste like? What's the texture?
It's it depends because it's also very regional. So how they make it in that Ying is not how they make it in Bocas, for example.
Okay.
In Panama. Just to clarify.
Yeah. It's, I don't think I've ever had
it. I'm not gonna describe it because I don't like it. So
I love it. So you know, it depends. But it could be crunchy, it could be soft and moist inside and crunchy outside.
So it could be like a stew.
No, it's like French fries. I like it sauteed.
Oh my god, I can't.
But there's no okra. I can't deal with the okra. I can't.
Oh, yes, Nyahu.
Oh my goodness, I hate okra. Like, I cannot.
What is wrong with you all? I might have to leave Caña Negra.
Eating these things.
No, what about sauce?
I fuck with sauce.
I like sauce.
Yeah. Okay. I learned that the southern U.S. also makes sauce too.
Yeah, but not the same.
Yeah, it's not the same, but they make it. But I want to take it back to, like, what we were talking about at the beginning, which is the dragging, right?
Mm-hmm.
We talk, you know, as our commentary is usually centered with, like, Black gays in Latin America. Who deserves to be dragged? We in quarantine. We going to get our quarantini.
I know who deserves to be dragged.
And I think that there's need.
I mean...
Right. So shout out to Brugal. What you drinking, Genevieve? What's your quarantini drink of choice? Libation.
Oh, I've been drinking hard cider. That's what I drink.
Hard cider. Okay. So Genevieve has been drinking hard cider. I'm gonna pull out some Henny White, and we are going to have some conversation. I think we should invite people, to Genevieve's point, to kind of have this conversation. Like, we dragging, because sometimes you need to sit with your friends and talk shit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So maybe we should make this.
Well, who needs to be dragged? I mean, this is a clue.
All right.
The Brugada is a clue. And
so,
I don't think they need to be uniquely dragged, though. That's the difference. People use Dominicans as a punching bag, and their anti-Blackness is not unique or new or novel or the last. And so I just want to say that before we go into it, because I think a lot of it is warranted. Because their Dominican anti-Blackness has been long-reaching and far, far-reaching. But Dominicans are not unique. I want to keep that, like, centered.
Yes. I was going to add, the people that need to be dragged, you know, and I think we should go, like, way back and then work our way up, right? And I do believe... I'm
so
with
historical everyone. To contemporary dragging.
Yeah, this is bring it all the way back.
You know what? Because that's what quarantine is bringing out of us, right? We are sitting back. We are thinking, right? Let's make this a community therapeutic experience. Right. We're dragging people in their anti-Blackness.
Right. So who would I drag? All right. So I would drag, and I can't remember his name.
Oh, you're doing specifics.
Oh, yeah. But they represent a group of people. When we say drag, right, and we think about an individual, that individual represents a group of people.
Yeah.
Because society wants to make it seem that that these things are individual instances that happen to us.
Yeah.
But they're really not. And we know that, right? So I want to drag, if I could go back, I will drag, and I cannot remember his name. But I had just changed schools in Panama. And this little white boy, called me a chomba. Chomba is a when it's a derogatory term, like the N-word, and when used by white people, right? And it's mostly white people that use it against Black people in Panama to put them in their place or to try and put them or put us in our place, right? The same way it's used here. It's the same kind of power dynamic that is used here.
Yeah. And then conversely, though, because my grandmother calls me chomba, and I love it. So like you said, it's like the N-word. Like, it just depends on who's saying it and what the intent is and the context and the tone.
Correct. So, and I can't remember what happened, but it was like in between the buses, like los colegiales, like after school.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I remember I got into a kerfuffle with him or something. And the next day I pretended to be sick.
So I didn't have to go back to school. Mm-hmm. And I was sent to my grandmother's house, which is where we went when we got sick. And I had a mighty good old day. But then when my dad went down, you know, he asked me what was actually happening. And I told him, right, he called the school and he had words with that teacher. And the teacher said something in the classroom and said that I had beautiful skin color canela. And that made it worse. Mm-hmm. Because this was a Spanish woman teaching Spanish, right? And so if I could drag, I would drag the little boy and the teacher.
For bringing attention, the teacher for bringing attention to
it? No, the teacher for being, for not, the teacher for like trying to smooth things over,
yeah,
and not address the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue is that he called me out of my name and he called me a racist derogatory term.
Yeah.
The issue is that the issue wasn't that I have beautiful cinnamon colored skin, which I do not. Right. The issue is that this man is a racist and you're trying, and this little boy is a racist. Probably from racist, racist parents.
Arrest this man.
Right. So this man, which is many white men,
yeah,
white Latino men that probably call girls that look like any of us,
mm-hmm,
all these nasty names behind closed doors or to our faces.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If I could, I would drag you through the mud.
I just want to point out Evelyn's West African Gap that I freaking love. They call it the West African Gap. Have you heard of that? The gap between the two middle teeth?
Mm-hmm.
My father has that, and a couple friends of mine have it. I love it.
When I was a kid, because you know, in so many parts of the world, they also say that people with gaps are like liars.
Oh.
That is like a belief, yeah. So.
So is that anti-blackness then? Even the gap tooth?
Yeah. So it's like that's like a thing. And it's funny because I heard it, you know, as a child, I only heard it from like my own people, because my dad has one also. But then a while ago, when I met Jude's uncle, he said the same thing, and he was raised in South Carolina. So that was actually like, wow, like who's to say that it probably is, you know, something that, some belief that people carry.
Wow.
But that was a fascinating thing. So I try really hard to like always tell the truth.
All right, next drag.
Oh wait, next drag. So who are you dragging, Dash?
Oh, I already told you. Well, no, they already got enough draggings.
And you know what? And it's kind of you to actually recognize that even within the dragging, we can say that there's a point where like the dragging becomes easy and almost unfair.
Yeah.
Right? That it becomes very easy to be like, oh, Dominicans are anti-black or whatever, right? But mm-hmm, that it's a lot more complicated and that they don't exist singularly. I think that their situation exists singularly in that they share such a close border, right, with like someone.
It's the same landmass.
Right. It's
like, and then let's also be clear. Who would be the exceptions to the drag within something like the Dominicans?
Right.
Okay, let's make that my drag then. And then we can break it down, because JV is sleeping with the enemy. No, I'm playing.
He cute.
No, he's fine.
No, but he's also very clear.
He's fine.
we part of the reason why we haven't been to the DR yet is because of that.
Uh-huh.
Part of it, right? Because one, we were not supporting investing money and spending money in the DR. Two, I would be considered a Haitian. I'm considered a Haitian here already by some of his family members. Guibin would be considered a Haitian by association. I've been told, right? His mother told me that I'm probably Haitian, because a lot of Haitians move to these countries and say that they're from these countries.
Mm-hmm.
So part of why we haven't been to the DR as a family is part of that.
But and is so, that also like with your human rights work, just your background? I've always posed that question, that should we not engage with these countries because of their anti-blackness, but then there's also the working population who depend on these tourism dollars. at the same time? Like, how do you reconcile that? That's been something I've, like, been trying to grapple with.
I was going to go this year. I was going to go to the DR. I think it was in June, end of June I was supposed to go, but to the border region, right, to work, to do work on the border, Haiti, the DR. I just, for me, going to the DR is a little bit different now. I wouldn't mind going to the DR if I were going specifically to work around anti-blackness or to connect and get to know more about the Black Dominican community. But for me, going to the DR now also means going to be with my partner's family, which I don't necessarily want to do just like that, because of their politics.
Oh, I see.
Right? So for me, having to, you know, that game of like having to like not be political and then have to engage in diffusing conversations because I don't want to engage in conversations. And then people knowing that these conversations piss me off and poking at me.
Yeah.
That's what the DR would mean to me.
Yeah.
In that, you know, having to stay with, you know, so that's what it would mean to me. And I don't want to have to engage. At my age, I don't put myself in those situations if I don't have to. So we were going to go because we were going to go to the border and then spend some time with his family. And that was it. Now, I would not be leading a delegation to the DR just because I'm not interested in it. But I would lead a delegation to Haiti.
Yeah.
And invite Dominicans.
So it's multi-layered. It's a multi-layered thing. Just like the Dominican dragging in general. I think a lot of it is warranted because they have policies and practices and norms and beliefs that are profoundly anti-Black, but at the same time, you can't blame the victim. You know, they don't know what they don't know. If for their whole entire life have been told this narrative of whiteness, of I'm Indian, and the Black people are the Haitians, and they're bad, you don't know what you don't know on one hand, right? Because on the other hand, it's like, wait, but you're actually mistreating another human. But it's extremely easy to mistreat someone who you don't identify as human or even related to you, or you don't see yourself in them. So when we're speaking about the Dominican and anti-Blackness topic, but as Evelyn said, it's a bit too easy at this point because they are not the only ones doing this and who have been doing this. And so on one hand, the dragging is completely warranted and you're just gonna have to eat that, you know, just period, across the board. Everyone's scapegoating Dominican anti-Blackness without reflecting on their own. Because the U.S., you know, the U.S. Afro-North Americans, sometimes believe that they're the leaders of Black pride, which, okay, some of that is warranted, but most of it isn't. Because I've heard my fair share of African Americans saying that they're not Black, they're mixed, or their grandmother's great-grandfather's niece was Indian, Cherokee. It's always Cherokee, right?
Indian in my family.
I got Indian, you know, or the constant question that what are you mixed with, that obsessive question. And so I don't think the U.S. is too far away from those white supremacist mestizaje ideals that are within the Latin American region, because it's always something that, oh, you, what you mix with, you can't only be Black or regular Black or just Black. And so those ideas, again, it's under white supremacy. And so I don't think Dominicans should get 98%, because they get 98% of it, 99% of the scapegoating. They should maybe get, you know, maybe 70%. Like, you know, they shouldn't be getting, they shouldn't be the punching bag, the sole punching bag in this conversation.
Yeah, they shouldn't be they definitely should not be. I don't think that they deserve being the only people that are punching bags. I think that part of the challenge for me that makes it difficult is that uniquely, in terms of the engagement that I have with people from Latin America, I think that particularly it's been shocking for me to receive the I'm not Black from Black people that often looks like in my case, that can often be Dominicans, right? That there will be Black people that are telling me I am not Black, or there's something wrong with Blackness, or that in the current conversations that we're having, despite being people that will acknowledge how recently they've acknowledged or accepted, right, their Blackness, the conversations are still centered there. Like, that pisses me off. Centered in, like, for example, when we talk about, like, Afro-Latinidad or something like that, like, people are talking about people who just discovered that they were accepted or acknowledged Blackness in, like, 2018, which still decenters people that have been living as Black people for the entirety of their lives. And that kind of pisses me off, because then that, to me, is not allyship, right? We're constantly looking for allyship. And I think that in many instances that there are people who have not been good allies, right? Even within Blackness, like, to be able to say that they're like, if I just discovered that I'm Black in 2018, then I need to be acknowledging people who've been living as Black people if I'm saying that all Blackness matters, right? And so for that purpose, I think that that dragging is relevant and deserved. Just because you opted to stop straightening your hair last year doesn't make you an expert on curls, right? Or the fact that there have been many Black people who have not been living with rizos. They have had naps. And they are happy with naps. They don't need to go to the salon to try to figure out a way to maintain or manage naps, because naps are okay as they come the fuck out of our head. So I think that there's...
Well, we don't look at a chart to figure out our curl number.
To be able to say, like, I, for example, is like this this constant association with, like, curls. And that's rooted...
Oh my God, I hate that shit.
That's like anti-Black.
Of course.
Enough with the rizos. Enough. Not every Black person has rizos.
Right. And if you have rizos, like, ain't that, you know, nothing wrong with you and your rizos, but recognizing that that's, you're still suggesting that having that rizo is goals, right?
Yes.
And so is there a level of anti-Blackness in that subtext when you're suggesting that if you don't have these perfectly spiraled curls, that somehow your hair lacks, like, treatment or support, you know what I mean? Like, all these other positive things. I love myself and I got naps. Like, back up off me.
You know what gets me so pissed? It's the people that have, like, the rizos and the this. They're the ones, most of them are the ones that are like, pelo malo no existe. And I'm like, are we really to believe this from you?
Right. Well, you don't even do shit. You don't get into the pool because you're afraid to wet your fucking hair. But you're talking about, like, please. Please.
I'm like, I need somebody with an afro, somebody with locks, somebody with, like, to tell me pelo malo no existe. I don't need somebody with the perfect, you know, like, part and the curls and the thing.
Yeah.
Like,
it's very easy for their hair to be accepted over the naps.
Right.
Because they've been told que ellos tienen pelo bueno.
Right. Yeah. Right. And
they don't have anything on the line. There's no risk. They don't have any skin in the game. Like, it's so easy for you to denounce something when you know you're not going to be affected by the societal norms and the repercussions, you know, because I can, and that's along with, you know, any privilege that we have, like foreigner privilege, foreigner privilege in a Black country. Yeah, I can say, let me speak to your manager and cause a ruckus, but I'm leaving in 2 days. You know, I don't have to live under that duress. I don't have to live under that oppression. So it's very easy for me to speak on it.
You weren't living there, right? Your association with, like, the U.S., with dollars, with all those other things, give you more power than people who live there every day. So it's like, so that also is another layer of the dragging. So I wouldn't say that the dragging is completely undeserved, but I think that there are some methods, there's some spaces that you still need to be, like, cognizant of the way that you're coming up or you're showing up in the space.
Yeah.
And that's really important too. Like, that's, and that's just something that I think people have to sit with.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, being aware of their social currency.
Yeah.
Like, we are social currency. Weight, beauty, you know, all of these things are social currencies. And I think within this Afro-Latinx space that we have to examine our social currencies, that, you know, they've always been social currencies in Latin America, because when someone comes dressed a certain way, you know how you look at social currency. Oh, that person has money. Oh, the hair is like this, so they must be, you know, all of these assumptions made. Well, Evelyn has to do her dragon.
So I have an aunt who I would like to drag, because all politics for me is local, right? Mm-hmm. I'm really grateful to have
house business, Evelyn. House business.
Listen, we cannot heal what we do not reveal, right? And so, therefore, right?
I'm scared.
We gotta. So, like I said, for me, politics is local, which is one of the reasons why I'm so grateful to be part of this trio, is because we're able to look at politics from different levels, right? Like from the, like I always joke about it, is like the federal level and the local government, right? Like you need to implement changes that are widespread, and then you also need to have changes that impact your day-to-day life. Yes. So
macro and micro, right?
Yes. So so for me, it's like, when I was a child, I have an aunt, she's alive, but like one of the things that I remember very clearly one day that she said, oh, your lips are so big and ugly, right? Yeah. Your lips are so big and ugly. And so she specifically told me that I needed to like bite my lip, right? So there was a way to like, you know, but kind of like almost bite on your lip so that when you were in pictures that your lip would not appear as big, and you would have, you would appear to have smaller lips. And I remember thinking at that time, like that was very transformational for me, because for a long time, like that affected my self-esteem, right? And the way that I saw my own beauty. And I recognized that that was like her thing. And I also recognize now as an adult that there are adults that teach you or do things with the desire to keep you safe or keep you protected, except that I don't think that was her thing. Like I, in retrospect, can say as an adult, I don't necessarily think that you were looking out for me. You were actively trying to like insult me. But that comment stuck with me for so long. Like it was something that I remember. And you know, it's funny because every once in a while, like I'll find pictures of myself when I was in like seventh and eighth grade, which was right around the time that she said that. And also thinking about the fact that middle school, what we know now is that middle school is such a critical time in somebody's life, right? You survive middle school and there's like a lot to be said for middle school survival. Yeah. But I remember thinking, wow, this lady, like, you know, she's basically telling me that I'm ugly. And how hurtful that was. And like my pictures now in seventh and eighth grade are all me with like not smiling and really clearly biting my lip to be able to not appear like I had the lips that are my size, right? And so later on when I got into high school and people were at some point like, wow, like you have great lips, like, you know, you should wear like dark lipstick. And I remember thinking, but I can't, like, I've already been told that my lips are not attractive, which was like a real sign of my blackness, right? Like I'm a black person with full lips. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that I didn't have words. And I think at the time, one of the things that we didn't support kids with generationally was to not be able to express themselves to adults, right? That they weren't able to say, I disagree with you, or I don't like that, or you hurt me. So I feel like that was something that was really difficult. And it would have been difficult and put my mom in an awkward position also, because any response that I would have given would have been perceived as disrespectful.
Yeah.
Right? And that's I think that for me, that's been something that I often have to like turn to as a pivoting space of, what is it that you want? What information, A, do you want to tell children? And then B, what information do you want them to know? And then how do we consistently position ourselves to be able to make them feel powerful about their appearance? Because that's such a critical part of the way that we engage the world.
how do we not project our own insecurities on our children? Because yep. your aunt probably, I'm not probably, certainly went through trauma with that, and she was projecting it on you. Mm-hmm. She's seeing something that she hates in herself reflected on her niece, which is the most mind-blowing part of this. It's your aunt.
Yeah.
It's not a stranger. It's someone that you know, your loved ones. And so she projected her hurt on you because there was nowhere else to put it.
Thanks, Evelyn, for sharing, right? Because and from sharing from, like, I think the three of us have shared from, like, this real space as well. And yours was, like, really close, right? And I feel that I definitely identify with that as well. And for me, it's like, people that are closest to us sometimes project their insecurities onto us. Mm-hmm. And I feel that as children, we, you know, their regrets, people's regrets and people, what people have seen as like, if I were like more like this, I could have done something different, is projected onto us as children.
Yeah.
And girls' bodies, right? Girls' bodies always are something that people, up until today, right, that people still have, and people that are close to us still have this relationship around, like, this control and that they can say stuff about it, right? And I used to do work with teenagers in high school, and that was something that they always spoke about, especially the prepubescent ones. Mm-hmm. Whose breasts were coming in, and some of them breasts came in really fast, and everybody in the family would notice, right, and have something to say about it.
I hate that shit.
In a way that wasn't constructive or nurturing to them, but more in a way of like, you know, now you're a grown woman, everybody's gonna be looking at you, na na na, or like, don't be coming home pregnant, you know, like stuff like that. That is like, yeah. Wow, like. Your breasts are just coming in. It's already hard enough to deal with, like, the feeling of that, the pain of that. I remember it being painful.
Yes, it was. It's painful. I remember, like, one time my sister accidentally, like, punched me in my breast when they were coming in. To this day, I feel the pain in my chest, Gonyo. Like, the...
Yes. So I'm feeling that,
right now, traumatized right now.
Yeah.
On top of that, having uncles and aunts and mothers and fathers and neighbors and fucking gardeners, right? Talking about it and commenting, and there's real pain that is caused by that. Something that I've been thinking about is. I used to teach, right, writing class around violence against women, and this was one of my chapters. Like, my units was this, like, body image and the violence that has been done to our bodies based on, like, relationships. But it's not violence, like, physical violence, it's just violence, like what you just spoke about, Evelyn, because, you know, everyone acknowledged that was violent. That was violent.
And sometimes, like, it manifests itself as, like, you know, it's mental violence and emotional violence, but it can trigger, like, physical violence, right? Because I can physically feel the way that I felt today, over 30 years later, the way that I remember feeling, like, you know, sometimes like somebody gives you news and it like hits you in your chest and you almost feel like, right? Like that feeling of your chest is caving in a little bit. Like I can feel that. I can go right all the way there.
Yeah. And you know, Evelyn, you know, I feel that you're a person that has done a lot of work on herself, right? So you're very aware of different things about yourself and who you are and et cetera, et cetera. But not everybody has been able to do that work and really deal with these things. So that will take people back, because sometimes I'm 46, but sometimes I'm 5 years old again.
Yeah.
And I act like I'm 5 years old, and I have to catch myself because I'm like, oh my God, Jean-Pierre, like you need to like move past this. This happened to you when you were 5 or 6 or 10 years old, like get it together. You have children now kind of thing. Right. But sometimes we don't have the skills or the tools to move past the age where something has happened to us and we're stuck there.
Yeah.
So if Evelyn didn't have the skills, right, in herself, because nobody can push us to do that work, right? If Evelyn didn't have that within herself, and the access to do that, everyone would still be
yeah.
that little girl whose aunt told her about her lips.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. And that's important. I think that it's really important to be able to build community that also you can explore this with and just kind of feel what you feel comfortably so that you can feel something else, right? So that you can get closer to the feeling that you want to feel. Because if not, you're internally doing all of this work to try to like self-manage, navigate, and manage yourself that can be so hurtful and exhausting. It is exhausting physically and emotionally. And we want to be here for you throughout this time because a lot of this stuff will come up during this quarantine that we have. So, Caña Negra community, tell us how we can support you. Feel free to write us at radiocañanegra@gmail.com. But also, tune in because we're going to yes. be doing some live Zooms where you can bring your drink. Show up your drink, Dash, your Brugal or your hard cider or your Henny White or whatever it is that you got. And you can sit and drink with us. And Genevieve and I were joking earlier that we should have a cry-along.
Yeah. Because,
like, we have like this, you know, we have like a sob that is
un desahogo,
right? Un desahogo de comunidad. Like,
yeah, we need to cry.
Sob stuck in our throat. Like, so maybe, being able to let free, to release the emotions in community that are coming up for us through this quarantine,
and be able to share, yeah,
with others, right?